Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area. Hi, welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan, live in the studio. We'll be hearing from my co-host Ethan Elkind later in the hour. He's interviewing San Francisco author Diana Capp about her new book, Girls Who Green the World. Be sure to stay tuned for that. Earlier this month, hundreds of students walked out of San Francisco, a private high school called Lick Wilmerding, to protest the school's handling of sexual assault and violence. This comes after a wave of walkouts at Bay Area public high schools last fall that culminated in a demonstration in front of San Francisco City Hall on December 10th. Here to help us understand why this so-called youth Me Too movement is happening, and also how adults are responding to these protests, I'm joined by health educator Shafia Zaloom. She's the author of Sex, Teens, and Everything in Between. Welcome to State of the Bay, Shafia.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm pleased to also be joined by Rosie Boltman. She's a senior at Berkeley High School, and she's the founder of Crash Course Consent. Welcome, Rosie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And as we start our conversation, a quick heads up, this conversation about student walkouts and protests will include discussions about sexual harassment and violence, and some listeners might find the topic challenging to listen. But if you can hang with us, I wanted to invite you to join the conversation that we are having. It's an important one. And I'd like to ask these questions to you. Are you a student at a Bay Area high school, or are you a teacher or administrator or parent and guardian? And can you share a perspective on the prevalence of sexual harassment and assault and harm for these young people? Also, what kind of support and education do you think students need around sexual harm? We're going to open up our phone lines early, so give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or send us a message on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Rosie, you're a senior at Berkeley High, and I wanted to start with you. In the last 6 months, students around the Bay Area have been protesting about sexual harassment and assault. And as a high school student, can you give us a window into the issues that you and your classmates are facing?
Yes, I can. I think that there's two or three main issues around sexual harm on high school campuses. I think primarily there's this culture, this rape culture, where people that perpetuate sexual assault and sexual harm are generally accepted on high school campuses. So these walkouts are a way to say, like, hey, this is not okay. If you have sexual assault allegations or something, like, we're not accepting you as a school. I think the second thing is that students are really frustrated at how school administrations have handled sexual assaults on campus. I know many people that have gone to our school administration and have reported the same sexual harassment or sexual assault instance 5-6 times, and nothing has been done. They still have to be in class with these people. They still have to exist around them, and the people are not even suspended, let alone expelled. And then I think lastly, the last thing that people are protesting is how unaware teachers are of sexual harassment when it occurs in front of them. I think that at Berkeley High School, there's been people complaining about getting sexually harassed in the halls. I've been sexually harassed in a classroom in front of a teacher, and he didn't really know what to do. And so I think that students are calling not only for an end of this acceptance of rape culture, but for school administrations to do better when it comes to training teachers and punishing people who promote sexual harm.
Well, and I don't want to just have you relive the trauma of being harassed, but can you tell us a little bit about what is happening in the classrooms or the hallways? How does it feel to be a young woman walking through the halls of your high school?
Well, in my personal experience, I've been catcalled at school a few times, which is pretty icky, like on the way to a football game or other things like that. I do know people that have been groped in the hallways, especially on our big Spirit Day rally day. There's a lot of groping and physical sexual harassment and assault within the school hallways. They're so busy. Mm-hmm. So if somebody wants to slip their hand in some part of your body, it would be pretty easy and pretty hard to detect. So I know a lot of people have experienced that. I have not. And then people will ask each other out, or they'll get rejected, and then sometimes they'll throw a fit that turns into sexual harassment, which also happened to me personally. So that's the stuff that's happening in my school.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that, Rosie. And I wanted to turn to you, Shafia Zaloom. You are an educator and you're the author of this book, Sex Teens and Everything in Between. As you listen to Rosie describe her experience at her school, how does that hit you as an educator and somebody who's worked very hard to help students understand sexual assault, sexual consent, and all those issues?
I think it's always, I mean, as an educator, I'm committed to learning spaces and schools as places where we hopefully are aspiring to everyone feeling like they can belong and acquire an education equitably and engage in authentic connection with each other, because that's how we thrive and what we need in the world to move forward and do well. And when I hear things like that, it's really upsetting. It's heartbreaking to me. And I have been working at Berkeley High School. I'm the consent educator there this year as a result of the student activism that took place that Rosie was also a part of, and we collaborate sometimes. Mm. And so, you know, in our work together and hearing sort of the stories, understanding what's been going on, you know, it really is, it's heartbreaking. It's concerning. As an adult, I really want to make sure that I'm responding in a way that's going to contribute to information, kids understanding more, and also how they can sort of support themselves as well as each other within the context.
Yeah, as an educator, and you've been doing this for a while, have you seen any changes in how sexual assault is metabolized by kids these days? Is it different? Is it the same, but we just have more knowledge and more ability to share out these stories?
You know, I think it's a combination. Me Too activism in particular, which I feel like in many ways started the ball rolling when it comes to this. And then two, for young people in particular, you know, thinking about what is it that I can do if I'm not yet 18 and I can't vote, if I'm in a school in which I can't, you know, I don't feel like the adults are necessarily paying attention to what I want them to or listening to me. What are my options, right? Like, what are ways to get attention and shine light on an issue or a problem that we want the adults to address? And I think that, you know, over the years and what I've seen, it's not that, and we all know this, right, that like sexual violence is no longer, is something that hasn't existed before now. It certainly has existed for as long as history has been written. And I think there's a combination of things that have happened, right? So I think that the Me Too movement in particular has inspired a lot of youth and young people to come forward. I think that young people have also thought about different ways, given social media, as well as, you know, the walkouts and the option to participate in them, as ways to make a difference and to create change and cultural shifts. I think that it's hard to say if there's an actual increase or more people feel comfortable stepping forward. What we do know, and this comes out of the Department of Justice Office of Education, I mean, Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Justice, is that in 2019, it was reported that in public kindergarten through 12 schools, sexual violence had increased by 55%.
Wow. From
2015 to 2018. And so, you know, is it an increase in incidents or are people more comfortable coming forward? I actually think that there may be a combination. You know, I'm a social sexuality educator, and so I really look at context. Right? Like what's happening in the culture in ways that may be perpetuating, normalizing this sort of culture that veils sexual violence and harm in things like humor or normalizes it, dismisses it, justifies it in ways that creates a platform for, you know, more of it to scaffold higher and to become more intense and challenging.
Well, I wanted to pick up on something you just said, Shafia, which is that how people try to brush it off and dismiss it. And the classic, you know, you get harassed or somebody does something. I was just kidding. You are just being so sensitive and, you know, get over yourself and stop being so hypersensitive.
I mean, I'm like a middle-aged woman, and I have a hard time coming up with riposts to that. Like, what do I say to that? And I'd love to know how, just to give our listeners out there some tools, like, how would you recommend that we respond to somebody who harasses you, and then the next breath's like, I was just kidding.
You know, I think that there are different ways, and this is bystander intervention is something that we know is effective when it comes to preventing sexual harassment and assault, right? Where peer-to-peer intervention, where people stick up for and stand up to in the face of this kind of bullying. It really is an extreme form of bullying. And it's so interesting that once we sort of talk about things within a context of sexuality, how things start to become different and viewed in different ways. Because when it comes to bullying, everyone pretty much got on board with how we would stand up to it. I would ask questions. I think it's important to be assertive, not aggressive, because we don't want to compound the issue, but we want to be really clear about what we are standing up to and to narrate. So it depends on what your comfort level is. You know, there's a lot of different, Green Dot has a beautiful way by which they help kids remember, people remember, direct, distract, delegate. So you could directly say to someone, that's harassment. You're making me uncomfortable. Stop. You could, if you saw this happening to someone else, distract them and say, hey, because you want to interrupt the dynamic. Hey, let's go do something over here or help me do X, Y, and Z and get them out of that situation and disrupt that dynamic that they're engaged in with this other person. Or you could delegate. And if you don't feel safe in that moment for whatever reason, you know, those things, like you said, they throw us off balance. Mm-hmm. And when we're off balance and we aren't grounded, we can't always recall what we would want to say in a moment, which is why sex education is so important, right? Because you can go over with young people, well, what would you say in that moment? And that's not to say it'll happen in context, but I think the probability of it happening would. And if you were witness to someone being thrown off balance, the caring and community building thing to do would be to help them when they're stumbling. Right. And so a way to do that then would be to say, hey, not okay. Or let's go do something else right now. And then maybe bring it up in a different context, or go and get the person that person came with and say, your friend's involved in some pretty sketchy behavior. You might want to go do something. So there's a lot of different ways that we can intervene when these sort of things come up. And when we're thrown off balance, you know, what's in our back pocket that we can call upon to help us be grounded again? And I like the question, what do you mean by that?
Ooh, I like that one. I'm getting tools for my toolbox. This is amazing. This is so great. I want to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're discussing student protests at Bay Area high schools around sexual assault. We have with us Shafia Zaloom. She's the author of Sex, Teens, and Everything in Between. We're also joined by Berkeley High School senior Rosie Boltman. Are you a student at a Bay Area high school? Or are you a teacher, administrator, or a parent? And do you have a story to share about your perspective on the prevalence of sexual harassment, assault, and harm? And what kind of support or education do you think students need to combat this? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Rosie, I wanted to pick up on something that Shafia said, which is bystander and peer education, which is something that I think you're doing. You know, you're a busy high school senior, so among all the things that you're doing, this is something that you've done, is to create a program to combat the problem by educating your peers. Tell us a little bit about the videos you've made and what the goals are for them.
Yeah, so last year, my junior year, I wanted to create a video campaign in order to combat sexual harassment, sexual assault, any sort of sexual violence or harm on our high school campus. And going into the creation of the videos, I had to be really careful as to what I really wanted them to address. Who did I want them to reach, and what did I want to tell people? And I decided, along with two other students who were brainstorming with me, that I really wanted to target people who just didn't know, because I think so much sexual harm happens by people who just don't really know exactly what they're doing. And that's not to say that some people go in with a lot of malicious intent to sexual situations, but I think that so much sexual harm can be prevented when you just simply tell people you need to ask for consent in this situation. And if you don't, that is assault. That is harassment. So that's the target audience that I had. And then as for what I wanted to actually tell them, I wanted to give students situations, scenarios, examples that they've lived or will probably live in the future and give them skills in those situations. Because I think that we've received a little bit, I would say it's pretty minimal, sexual consent education at my school. And I found it to be really abstract freshman year as somebody who had never really been in any sort of like romantic or sexual relationship in any serious way. I was just like, well, what does this mean? Like, I can't visualize any situation in which this would be useful. And okay, like, I know this is consent and this isn't consent, but how do I ask for it? How do, like, what is, you know,
right.
I had a lot of questions. So these videos were meant to answer those questions. So we've made 3 videos now, and the video series will continue next year. Our first video was not awkward ways to ask for consent, because I hear so many people say, asking for consent is so awkward, I don't know
right.
how to do it.
Right.
So the video details when you need to ask and different ways that you can ask, short ways that aren't super weird and rigid,
well,
that also get the proper message across.
I love that you're doing that. I mean, because you're either getting your information from friends or you're trying. I mean, I can understand if it's hard to understand what it is when it's so abstract. And I think we actually have a clip from one of your first videos. I want to play it here. Let's hear that.
When you know what your partner wants and ensure that they are comfortable, sexual activities are more pleasurable and enjoyable for both parties. Some people think asking for consent is awkward, but we are here to illustrate some non-awkward ways for you to ask for consent. What feels good to you? Are you sure you're ready for this? How far do you want me to go? Do you want me to keep going? Do you want me to stop? Is there anything you want to try? Are you all right? Do you want to try something else? What are you into? If your partner is obviously not into what you're doing, it's best to speak up then and ask if they want to take it slow. Even after all our suggestions, you may still feel awkward when asking for consent, but it is still important to remember that the minor discomfort you feel while asking for consent can save someone from feeling violated or uncomfortable by you.
Well, I think that's pretty clear and not awkward. So, I mean, you want to, it's better than watching an episode of HBO's Euphoria, right? It explains it a little bit more. Rosie, so I've heard you told our producer that these videos have kind of led to conversations in the hallways about consent. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I've been fortunate enough to see in front of my eyes positive changes happening, and I would like to think that some of them are due to the videos that we put out. I know that just within my circle of friends, people are more conscious of general boundaries. Like, I have one friend that just really hates being hugged, and now after kind of talking about these videos, people always, like, check in and are like, hey, do you want a hug right now? Or, like, do you not want a hug? And that's a basic level of consent that I've just seen kind of grow over my high school years. I know that, you know, maybe my friends aren't like everybody, but within my circle, it's something that's sprouted up. And then also, there's been some really, really great moments for me, namely on the track team. These freshman boys were talking about girls, and I asked them, I was like, I wanted to, like, test them a little bit. I was like, but you guys know about consent and when you need to ask for it. And all 3 of them, there's 3 of them, they start kind of talking over each other, trying to compete to prove to me who knows more about consent. And then one of them finally goes, you have to ask for consent every time you make another move. And I was like, yes, like that's exactly what we said in our videos. And they said that they had talked about it a lot in class following the videos, that their teacher kind of took it upon herself to have a conversation afterwards. So I've seen a few positive changes like that. And while the problem still exists I do see slow changes, and it's really encouraging for me as somebody that's trying to make a difference.
Well, Shafia Zaloub, as an expert in this, what do you think about Rosie's consent videos? And also, tell us why a simple say yes or say no approach doesn't really work.
Yeah, I think the videos are phenomenal. I've had so much fun, you know, getting to know Rosie, and have been so inspired by her leadership and what she's trying to do with her videos, and how collaborative the process has been, which I think is amazing, and that the group that she leads is incredibly diverse and representative of different social groups on campus, which I think is awesome. You know, when it comes to videos, I think those are helpful. I think when it comes to education in general, we know this when it comes, you know, best practices is that we have to provide and present a variety of inroads and ways by which kids can learn this information. And there's learning the information, and then there's figuring out how to apply the information to the complexities of human relationships. And I think that's where a lot of other programs, or where other programs, you know, have an opportunity to improve, is to not just give a definition, to not just tell kids, right, like in this abstract way, respect, you know, whomever, respect your partner. Because so many young people will come to me and say, okay, I understand what the definition of consent is, but what does that mean for me? What does that mean for me on Saturday night? What does that mean for me when I'm walking down the hallway and someone grabs my butt? Like, what does that mean? And so, you know, I think that the videos are a really great way. The tech skills are amazing that this group of young people have. And the music and the language is really concrete. And I think that's something we forget, is that this is actually a pretty abstract, and as adults, we want to be responsible and never create a situation where kids feel like they have to have experiential context to understand what we're saying. So, you know, it's also reading your kid. Like, what kind of a kid do you have, and what resonates most with them? How do they learn? And as parents and parenting adults, caretaking adults in young people's lives, like, what are the multiple ways we can say something or introduce a topic or explore and express it with a young person that really models the very thing we're trying to get them to understand? And I think that's the most important piece, because this is about how we treat each other. Right. And how that matters. This is about how we connect. This is how we build community. This is how we treat each other in our relationships. And so as many ways as possible that we can engage in this dialogue, whether it's videos or classroom instruction or a conversation in the car or late at night when your kid comes home with their friends, go downstairs and start making food. You know, like, just listen and talk less and listen more. I think the biggest challenge for parents and other caretaking adults, including school, you know, teachers and administrators, school folks, school adults, is that we weren't modeled this either, right? Like, so this isn't something that we got at all. So, you know, it's a messy business in terms of how to do this, because we're learning, we make mistakes. I still make mistakes. And it's hard, because when that happens, you know, there's the potential for someone being hurt or not heard or whatever it is. And then the other part of it is, you know, we live in a culture that's a meritocracy that tries to avoid what's awkward and what's difficult and uncomfortable. And so, you know, I think it's even more important that we recognize how important healthy vulnerability is, which is essential to connection.
It's such a good point. And actually, we have a comment from a listener. She writes, or he writes, I'm a parent of preteen boys, and I'm not a prude, but I'm dreading the conversation about consent. I can't imagine my sons at that stage of life, and I worry that an innocent misstep by them might ruin their lives. Help! What do you say to this parent, Shafia, in terms of, you know, what should they do? I mean, make lunch downstairs and have a conversation about what consent is? Like, how do you launch into that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's overall sexuality education in general that includes consent, and that we aren't just talking about consent under this umbrella of sexual harm when it's absent, but how essential and important it is to positive, healthy, you know, romantic and or sexual exploration that's grounded in mutual respect, care, and dignity. Like it's also the floor, right? It's the foundation. It's the fundamentals. It's not the ceiling. It's actually a pretty low bar. And I get worried about how we focus so much on consent and then that's it, right? You check the box with an ask and you get a yes or you get a no and that's it. Because ultimately I think as parenting adults, we want our kids to engage in, you know, romantic and or sexual relationships when they choose that are going to enrich their lives and serve them. And so, you know, it's scaffolding over time. It's not one big talk. It's lots of collecting moments and, you know, dropping a question here, dropping a question there. I think it's important that parents understand, you know, it doesn't have to be this big, huge thing. And it's mostly about values. You know, when you're watching TV together, you could say, huh, what do you think about how they treated each other? Do you think they both got to walk away with their dignity? And your kid might go, well, what does that mean? Which is a great conversation starter. Or, you know, this happens all the time when it comes to the word respect. I hear, you know, well-intentioned parenting adults use the word respect constantly. And I'll be in a room full of 118-year-olds and I'll say, how many of you have been taught to respect yourselves and others your whole entire life? And every hand goes up. Right. But then I'll say, okay, who can give me, who feels confident in giving me a definition? Every hand goes down.
It's again that idea of if it's too abstract, you know, it's too intellectualized, yes, it's really hard to understand what to do. We have another comment from a listener. John writes, I'm a single dad with a teenage daughter. What can and can't I talk to her about? Should I be modeling anything for her? And I'm actually going to throw that to you, Rosie, as a teenage, a female teenager yourself. Like, what have been some successful conversations around sexuality that you've had with the grownups in your lives, whether that's a parent or a teacher or some other adult?
I think that I've had the privilege of having some really healthy conversations around sexual consent with my parents. I've been in queer relationships for my high school experience, so that also kind of changed the conversation around sexuality. I think it relieved my dad actually a little bit. But but advice for a dad, I think that as a dad, you need to check in with your daughter, and you have to make sure that you have to come to her and ask her if she's experienced any sort of sexual harm or if she needs any support in that sort of area. I remember there was this one time this really like old man started talking to me way too much and in a really creepy way in a restaurant, and I left the restaurant and I came home and I just started crying. And my dad, he at first was like, Rosie, why are you crying? And then the second I like said it, he like kind of dropped everything and he just kind of consoled me and he explained that it wasn't okay and that I was justified in feeling weird about it, because I think that a lot of the time victims of sexual harassment and assault, they feel like their feelings aren't justified. They feel, oh, I feel super weird and vulnerable and like I want to cry for no reason. So I think affirming her feelings, if you ever catch her in a situation like that, I think telling her what she should expect from a partner is really, really important, because I just know too many people that are taught what they should expect from a partner by a partner that's trying to manipulate them. So I think that those two things, you know, making her feel heard, checking in with her, validating her feelings, and then explaining to her what she deserves and what she should expect and what isn't okay in these types of situations, I think that would be amazing, and a lot more than a lot of teenage girls get from their father.
I mean, excellent advice. I think we should all be more like your father, too. So it sounds like he did some great modeling there. I mean, as we're talking about this issue, I mean, one kind of thinks of sexual harassment and assault as a woman or a girl related issue, but it really isn't. And I think one thing, just looking at this, at these protests, it's men and young men and young women who are protesting this. And I Rosie, as you've been to these protests, tell me about the experience of boys, how they've appeared as, unfortunately, as victims, but also as allies.
Yeah. So at the protest that I attended 2 years ago at my school, there were a series of speakers that went up. I think the first few were planned, but then it ended up being hours and hours of people coming up and detailing their experiences with sexual harm. So I think what I saw men doing, I did see a few male victims, and I really don't want to discount that experience and make it seem like sexual harm is only something that happens between a male perpetrator and a female victim, because it happens with all genders and all types of relationships. So I did unfortunately see a handful of male victims detailing their experience. I also saw a few boyfriends of girls who had gotten sexually harmed, you know, just kind of go up there and quite literally hold their hand while they detailed their experience and were just there as some sort of emotional support. I did also see a few guys go up and talk about their experiences on sports teams and other environments like that where this rape culture is really accepted. And there was one or two boys that went up and talked about how they had been complicit in sexual harm before, but they wanted to get better. I don't really know how much of that was performative and how much of it was sincere, but that aside, I think that guys in this situation, we have a guy who's working on our crash course consent team. I think that they can provide a lot of insight into what it looks like when a group of boys are in a room talking together, and that group of boys has been taught their whole life that it's okay to like harass women. So I think that if you're a guy and you want to help out in terms of these efforts, like providing that male perspective and telling what you've heard from your friends on your sports teams or just your friends in general is really helpful in furthering the conversation and making it more rooted in reality, I would say.
Well, I mean, that's such good advice. And Shafia, with a minute that we have left, I wanted to ask you, as adults, what should we be keeping our eyes out for when it comes to our kids, and how should we be opening up those conversations with them?
Oh, there's a few things. I think educating ourselves on sex positive sexuality so that we can embrace the role of being the primary sexuality educator in our child's life. I don't know a single professional sex educator who doesn't believe that to be true. And to really focus on the relationship piece, boundaries, child parent boundaries are super important. And really allowing your kid to be an expert in their own experience. I think that's the most important piece is, you know, becoming the askable parent, so which requires us to hold a space in which there is no judgment, no shame, no ultimatums, no guilt, where they can explore and express what they're seeing, what they're hearing, what's going on, and ask questions if they want to. And not to launch, but to really, in many ways, let them guide the conversation, but to be the energy behind it, or the inspiration, or the catalyst for it happening on a regular basis. But I really think allowing your kid to be an expert in their own experience is an important thing to remember, because they have a power that we don't, and that's to know what's happening when the adults aren't around.
That's such good advice, and you've given me a new life goal, Shafia, which is to be the askable parent. So I'm putting that into my head. That's really great. We're going to have to leave it there. Shafia Zaloom is the author of Sex, Teens, and Everything in Between. It's a great book, and if you have a kid, I recommend you get it and read it cover to cover. We've also heard from Rosie Bultman. She's a senior at Berkeley High School, and she has a YouTube set of videos called Crash Course Consent. Look for those. They're excellent. I want to thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about these issues that we've discussed, check out the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. Coming up after the break, my co-host Ethan Alkine talks to Bay Area author Diana Kapp about her new book, Girls Who Green the World. Stay tuned. It's a great interview.
For many, the words climate change can evoke a sense of dread. It even has an official name, climate anxiety. But we've got a hopeful story for you. We're joined by San Francisco author Diana Kapp, who just published the book Girls Who Green the World, featuring 34 real-life female ecopreneurs. So Diana, welcome to State of the Bay and congratulations on the book.
Thanks, Ethan. Nice to be here with you.
So tell us about Girls Who Green the World. Why did you choose the subject? And what was your target audience when you were putting the book together?
Girls Who Green is my second book, and the books have both been aimed at teenagers largely, although I'm finding that the audience often expands to the mom of a girl or the grandmother of a girl. So I wrote Girls Who Green the World because I believe that such a negative conversation has overtaken the dialogue about climate change. And what it's doing to young people is creating a real sense of overwhelm, a sense of anxiety that is not leading to action and a desire to get involved and engaged. And we really need young people to lean into this. So I wanted to point out that there are a lot of incredibly creative, bold women who are out there doing experiments and creating companies and technologies and approaches that are very inventive and are hopeful.
I'm sure it's hard to pick your favorite woman that you featured in this story, but can you give us a flavor for some of the women that you profiled?
There's so many cool women. One pair that is particularly interesting is doing a company called Lily and Augusta, and it's a pair of PhDs from University of Michigan. They graduated a year ago. And both of the women are African-American and wear their hair in cornrow braids. One night at a conference, lying in their bunk beds as assigned roommates, they were talking about how much their heads itched and burned because of the plastic that's in these braids that you weave in. And they found an incredibly creative solution, which is to use invasive weeds that are growing around Ann Arbor. And that fiber kind of mimics what the plastic was doing.
I'm wondering also if you detected any common themes or traits among these women as you step back and think about the 34 that you profiled. Did something kind of jump out at you in terms of commonalities or themes?
What I think is interesting is that most of these women did not know anything about the subject matter that they entered into. So Lynn Jurek, who's now put solar panels on 600,000 rooftops, and she's based in San Francisco with Sunrun. She was completely new to solar energy, and she learned as she went. She was told her idea was impossible, and that's the story you hear over and over again.
Cool. And you start with the remarkable story of Susan Solomon in the book. Can you share some of the details of Susan's story?
She's a place to start in this book because she was instrumental in the science that led us to understanding what was causing the ozone hole in the mid-80s. At that time, that was the big environmental panic of the day. And she went to Antarctica and she developed some theories about the chemistry. And she did the experiments. And what she found was chlorine dioxide levels 100 times normal. She sounded the alarm on chlorofluorocarbons, which were in underarm deodorant, spray can, hairspray. And that led to much alarm in the scientific community and the Montreal Protocol, in which every nation on Earth signed on to ban chlorofluorocarbons, which were the cause of the ozone hole. And it's the only time in history that every nation on Earth has signed on and banned and done the right thing. And it's just a great story that shows us that science is very important, and so is government policy, and it can work.
Yeah, it was truly one of the great environmental success stories from the last century. And also, you point out in the book that it was a female scientist who first discovered or pioneered the greenhouse gas effect and our understandings around that.
Back in the 1850s, she was not heeded, clearly.
Yeah, well, hopefully your book will play a part in at least highlighting some of the successes out there now. I'm curious about the subject of greenwashing. And anytime we talk about companies and their climate or environmental pledges, there's always a concern that they're talking but not actually doing. Was that something that you looked out for in assessing some of these stories and thinking about how companies play a role in the environmental movement?
My teenage kids made sure that I was constantly on the lookout for greenwashing. And it is something that is difficult to distinguish because everything in environmental science involves trade-offs. So you can't find a situation where it's a pure benefit. I'll give you an example. One of the companies is called Pulp Pantry, and they're using the byproducts from produce from juicing. And their packaging right now is not compostable. But what Caitlin Magenthal, who's the founder, says is most municipal compost systems cannot handle packaging right now. And so even if she created the compostable packaging, it wouldn't be composted. So that's just an example of it's not because she's not trying to walk the walk. She wants to do the responsible thing on her packaging. And so what she's done instead is she's made her bag smaller. She's had two layers instead of three, you know, just doing the best she can to minimize. But she's hoping that as the compost systems catch up with us, then she'll move to the compostable packaging.
And after writing this book, doing these interviews, has it changed how you live? Have you incorporated anything into your life that has come out of your research and discussions on the book?
I'm just thinking a lot more about consumption. I think in every part of my life, I can buy less, use less, reuse things. I'm getting really interested in clothes swapping rather than buying new. I eat less meat than I ever used to. I walk a lot more than I drive. So those are small things. The place I really want to put my effort is into political action aimed at the midterm elections, because I think those are the big levers we have to really make change in the short amount of time we have. And I'm encouraging all young people to join the Sunrise Movement and work for climate-friendly candidates.
Absolutely. It's going to take those systemic policy changes to really make a difference on the challenges that we face. I wanted to ask you about the reaction to the book so far. It's only been on the shelves for a few weeks, but what are you hearing, particularly from girls and young women out there reading the book?
The most exciting reaction I've gotten is from a young girl from the Grace Church School in New York City. And she emailed me literally about 15 minutes after I finished my talk at her school. I'm going to read a little bit of what she wrote. She said, "Although I call myself a perpetual optimist, the struggle to save our climate can sometimes seem dismal. At Grace, we do lots of talking without initiating action. I found your talk so influential because it gave us all drive and solutions. It showed that there is change happening."
Wow.
So that's what I hope. I really hope to inspire young people to feel a bit more sense of agency, that there is action we can take.
Yeah, it's got to be so gratifying to get an email like that. And I'm sure that's the first of many that you'll get in reaction to the book. And in terms of her question around taking action, the last chapter in the book is titled "Now What?" So what's your advice to readers about how to jump in and start making a difference, particularly on the issue of climate change?
Definitely to get politically active, to create a community for themselves of other young people who want to make change, because I think doing this in community is a lot more powerful than doing it in isolation. And I also direct them to my website, where I have a resources section at dianacap.com. And I'm listing, I have now about 200 ways that you can make changes, everything from a place that will pay teens to make TikToks and Instagrams on climate issues, to, you know, a letter you could write to a corporation to complain to them about their packaging, or a sample letter to your representative to demand action on fossil fuels.
Well, Diana Kapp, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. Congratulations. Thank you for writing it, Girls Who Green the World. You can find it on Amazon or at your favorite local bookstore. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ethan. The last word I'll tell you is you should buy the book at your local bookstore, because it's a much more environmental way to do it, and we need to keep these bookstores in business.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page at kalw.org. And if you have any comments or questions about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And if you have a story idea, send it along. Next Monday, we'll talk about the legalities and logistics of pursuing medically assisted death in California today. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb, Sydney Bernier, and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Tariq Ansari was our board operator. This is Grace Wan. Thank you for listening, and have a good night.